Hello, Lopez. I'm Lorna Reese, and I'm here today for the Lopez Writers Guild with our new radio show, Lopez Writers Read. If any of you listeners have ever attended one of our Writers Read evenings at Lopez Center, you know you have a treat in store for you, because we will be bringing you your friends and neighbors reading from their own writing work. In each program, we will talk with the writers about their work and their process, and they'll read a couple of pieces to us as well. This show is being pre-recorded in May of 2009. Our guest today is Kip Robinson Greenthal. Kip holds a BA in English Literature and Creative Writing from Sarah Lawrence College. Her previous work experience includes 18 years as a librarian in schools and public libraries. In 1993, she became the education director for Seattle Arts and Lectures, where she founded and directed the Writers in the Schools program until 2001. Now a full-time writer, Kip is currently working on a revision for her first novel, Shoalwater. In 2000, she was selected for the 2000 Jack Straw Writers Program and was also awarded a Hedgebrook residency. Her short story, Tattoo Emporium, has appeared in print, online, and through the publication of Currents, an anthology published by the Lopez Writers Guild in 2004. In January 2007, Elizabeth Austin selected her short story, Stealing, to be aired on KUOW's On the Beat. Stealing is a piece to be included in Kip's second novel, East Lee, a story about leaving her old family home. Hi, Kip. Welcome. I'm so glad you're here.
Hi, Lorna. Thank you for inviting me.
Let's talk first about the book you're writing right now, Shoalwater. Can you tell us how you came to write this book? Where and when did the idea originate?
I lived in Nova Scotia from 1971 to 1983, and I had been raised as a child on stories about Nova Scotia because my mother went there when she was a child, and those seemed to be her happiest memories, and that stuck with me years later when I ended up being fascinated and wanting to go to a distant place, which was Nova Scotia. And I think a lot of the motivation for going there was kind of trying to find a place where I remembered my mother being happy. And while I lived there, I worked in a small library in a town of 2000, Lunenburg, and became very fascinated by the way of life, the inshore fishing community, which in the early 70s was still a viable way of life, but there was the realization that it was also a dying way of life. And I was very influenced by a book written by Peter Barse, filled with beautiful photographs of the inshore fishermen and also transcriptions from actual interviews that he taped of the inshore fishermen and the villagers. So the story kind of came to me through osmosis, working in Lunenburg, which was near some of the inshore fishing communities. And then there was a major accident that I was aware of that had happened. And I have to say, I know some people say, "Oh, how can your story be inspired by an accident? That seems so kind of horrific." But the truth is that the accident did spur my imagination, and it ended up taking me back to the 1920s, the early years of the inshore fishing communities, and then bringing the story all the way back up to what is the mid-1970s.
So you got the idea for this story when you were in your 20s, or...?
No, I wasn't that young. I was 30s? In my late 30s.
Okay.
But probably, you know, I left Nova Scotia in 1983 when I was 37. And I actually got the idea of the story probably that last year I lived there.
So when did you start writing the story then?
Well,
it,
I wrote
it. Lived in your imagination
yeah,
for a while.
It definitely lived in my imagination, and I don't think I realized when I started writing that I was writing a novel. I remember sitting down and just writing some short scenes, and one of them was the accident scene that I described. And that, in writing that, I realized I wanted to know all of the characters who were who could have surrounded that scene, which was, you know, the accident occurred 10 miles off the coast of a village called Blue Rocks. So I think that was what led me to writing all different kind. I mean, short stories. I guess I was thinking at the time it was going to be a collection of short stories. And being a mother of two and working almost full time, it was, you know, it was an enterprise. But that's when I started.
Well, then how did you decide that it needed to be a novel?
I think the story decided it.
The characters said, I need more space.
Yeah. The characters needed a lot of space. So when I returned to the Northwest, interestingly enough, when I lived on my family farm, that was when a lot of the realization that this was a novel happened. I think there was something about looking back on that life in Nova Scotia that gave me a certain amount of freedom to explore the story and explore the characters in the story. I think my challenge with Shoalwater has always been understanding how to tell it, because the story is very vivid in my mind and in my imagination, but the telling of it has taken me some time. And I think it's partly because I didn't feel that I was a Nova Scotian, so who was I to tell the story? And it took me a long time to realize how much Kate and Andy are pivotal in the story, who are more like myself, Americans transplanted to Nova Scotia.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me some time to sort of figure out the dynamics of all of that.
Well, I was going to ask you about the structure of your book and how it's changed since you started writing it. So, I mean, it changed, first of all, from being a series of short stories into being a novel. How did you feel when you realized it needed to be a novel? Was it, oh, goody, I get to write a novel, or, oh, my God, I'm writing a novel?
It was, you know, it's interesting. I don't think when the story came to me, I superimposed anything on it, that it was going to be a series of short stories or was it going to be a novel. It basically led me, and when I say short stories was how I began it, I think at the time I just thought that because it made it approachable, it didn't feel too big or overwhelming.
Yes.
Then when I realized it really was a novel, fortunately, I was naive and innocent enough, and I didn't quite know what I was getting into.
That's a good thing sometimes, isn't it? A little
yes.
bit of ignorance?
Yeah, blissful ignorance.
Yes. Well, so what about the structure of your book? I know you've been working on it for a few years, and this is a revision, so is the structure something, too, that you tried something and you found that it didn't work, and so you decided, well, how did you come to the structure that you are set upon today, which you know is the right one?
Well, I think what happened was that to get the full scope of the story out, I worked with an omniscient narrator, and that's the storytelling voice. And in doing that, I worked chronologically with the story and also with the characters. And it gave me the arc of what I wanted to do with the book in terms of the characters and where the story actually would go.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't give me a certain depth of character that I really needed for the book. I mean, they always say you have, well, not they, but I just remember taking a writing course from David Bradley, and he said, you've barely begun unless you've written 7 drafts.
Yes.
So I would say that I wrote 2 drafts that really were from the omniscient point of view, And I'm very grateful for those drafts because they move chronologically. They gave me the fabric of the story. I got to know my characters. But now, in going back, it's quite striking to me how much I'm leaving out from the original drafts. But it's okay because that is the way I got to know these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm working quite differently. I'm not working chronologically now. I'm working with a lot of freedom with time, I guess is the best way to put it.
I like that. Well, your novel has a magical realism aspect to it. And I wondered, first, would you explain what that is to readers or listeners who might not know what that is? And then tell us why you decided to use a magical realist approach to the story, when your fiction is pretty grounded in everyday experience.
It's fortunate I heard Gary Snyder on the radio this morning, who's a poet, speaking in Seattle tonight. And he said to Steve Scherr, please don't ask me to define the word magic. A poet just would never want to define that word. And so I thought about magical realism, because it is true, there is magical realism in the book. And I think what I believe is magical realism addresses some issues, in basically thematic issues, that can be very hard in a story. And it gives breath, it gives a luminous thread, it gives grace, it gives hope. That's how I see the magical realism, and it's a legend that haunts the story, it opens the story. And the what I see happening with the magical realism that basically is embodied in the Silky legend, that magical realism gives hope and a sense of possible transformation, that there can be change, that nothing is static, even in the hardest and the most difficult of times. And that's what I personally love about magical realism. When I looked up the word magic, it said to make possible that which you believe is impossible.
Oh, that's a wonderful definition. So did you know when you started to write the novel that you were going to use magical realism, or is that something that came along the way in a eureka moment or
something? It came along the way. You know, when I first wrote The Seal Legend, it was here in the Northwest after I had already started the story in Nova Scotia, and I really was startled by writing it. I thought, where did this come from? Because it wasn't at the time, it didn't seem to have any relationship to the main characters in the book, except characters who had lived in Slate Harbor years before the main characters. And so I would say my job as the person who's trying to deliver this story has really been to try to understand this legend. You know, the deeper I've let myself sink into it and its meaning, the more I've really been able to understand better what is possible for the characters in the actual narrative. And it's been a fascinating story for me, or an experience for me. It's like maybe how a sculptor feels when you know, he's looking at rock, or she's looking at stone, and letting the stone reveal the shape that she's working on. That's what I feel with that the legend has done for me with this book.
That's a lovely way of putting it. I think this might be a good time to hear something from your book. So will you tell us what we're going to hear, and then we'll listen?
Well, I chose what I'm going to read today because I have read The Seal Legend and at the Lopez Center, so I thought it'd be nice to do something different for KLOI. And this is the first chapter that takes place after The Seal Legend. And I guess the main character in this particular chapter is Lena. And Lena was a child when the Seal Legend actually took place, and just to take away a little of the mystery of the seal legend, it's really a story about a fisherman drowned. Everybody, the villagers, thinking a fisherman drowned, but then indeed the fisherman was saved by a seal. And the sad element in the legend is that the villagers could not believe that Basil was indeed saved by a seal. Lena, however, who was 6 years old at the time, did believe that Basil was saved by a seal, which shows the innocence of a child's imagination and also the magical power of a child's imagination, which Lena has been able to keep throughout her adult life. So this story opens now in 1957 in a small inshore fishing community called Slate Harbor. It's a fictional name. With Lena now as a young married woman and also a mother after the seal legend.
Okay, good. Thank you.
In Slate Harbor, no woman goes out alone in a dory. Keeper of the house and garden on land, a woman navigates the earth. It's the men who go out on the nervous water, morning after morning. They get up in the dark light, memorize their steps down to the wharf, hear their own feet in the sea's breath, the gull on the small back of a breeze. But on this particular morning, Lena had to go out. She'd taken to doing some strange things of late, like go to the small church in the center of the village where she and Will were married, sink inside a pew on her knees. But she didn't know how to ask Reverend Murray for the help that she needed. She was so tired. She thought the sea must be as tired as she was, the way it gets beaten up by the wind and the rain and that waste of sun on a hot August day. The sea lies there, so tireless and patient, at the mercy of Mother Nature. The sea is a woman, Lena thought. But now she wanted to be by the sea, because she knew the sea would be itself, whether it was rough or silent or flat, and she wanted to be with that honesty. The sun was brilliant inside the bowl of the cove as Lena descended to the water's edge, and she still carried the picture in her mind of being a different woman from the one she'd become. For she had wanted to be a schoolteacher. She'd dreamed of this since she was 12 years old when she lay in her bed in the dark, and instead of listening to the sounds of her father who had too much liquor inside him, she would sing a little tune to the white-painted wall of her room. And the tune would take her to far-off places, the moving Atlantic sky, past the rooftops and the steeple of the church standing against the ocean, the small bent junipers that patterned the slope. She'd have her father's nautical maps hidden under her pillow, and she'd let the tips of her fingers rest on a choice of cities, Boston, Vancouver, San Francisco. She was going to be a schoolteacher there. In a chocolate wool suit and an ivory silk blouse, she was going to walk down aisles lined with wooden desks in a place far away from Slate Harbor. But up until this point, she hadn't become that woman. She couldn't say why, she just hadn't. Instead, it was midday in Slate Harbor, and she was peering out over the cove that was drained of wind and the Cape Islanders gone out with their fishermen, and she was fighting her own emptiness as she looked at Will's dory that sat by itself, tethered to the buoy. A terrible urgency moved inside her hands and out through her fingertips, stained with the beets she'd been preserving that morning, and she drew on the line to bring the yellow dory in, and the rope chafed in her palms as she thought about Will and how this was second nature for him to pull on the rope that caused those small calluses she felt from his hands when he squeezed her skin in the night. And the still water mirrored back the yellow dory as it floated towards her. And she thought maybe if she climbed in the boat and went out just offshore, she could see things differently from how she was seeing them now. Maybe she could understand better the world that was Will's. For Will was a conscientious man, she told herself, and when they had married, he promised that he understood her dreams and that they would live them. Will had grown up only 4 houses away from Lena, and though they had the same surname, they were only distantly related. Lena's father had raised her saying that Slate Harbor was the oldest fishing village in Nova Scotia, and a fellow should take some pride in that. "You're a tanner, you," he'd say. "There are only three or four families who originally settled here, and you're one of them, Lena. First settlers, every last one of us." Probably two-thirds of the village had the surname Tannard, and Lena had heard her mother say these families knew far too much about each other. They knew so much about each other that the knowledge went inside them like rock salt over dried herring. Everyone knew, for example, that Lena's father came home drunk in the night. Everyone knew it, but no one said anything, not even her mother or her brothers. Lena used to lie in her bed and listen to her father's leaden steps climb the stairs every night, and then her mother's bird-like voice greet him with Lauren, and then that thudding darkness. But Will Tannard seemed different from most of the men in Slate Harbor. Lena thought he was smart because he didn't go down on the rocks and drink too much liquor with the others. She remembered being 13, when Will waited for her on the long gray road to the schoolhouse, and how she had confided in him about thinking Slate Harbor was the end of the world. She told him how she sat on the rocks beneath the cliff and listened to the roar of the ocean, and how she could imagine the sound of water traveling for thousands of miles from Europe and Africa to Canada and back, and how she'd think about traveling these distances herself, far away from Slate Harbor. She could leave this place just like the water, she told Will. "You must be smart, you," Will would tease her. "And Mrs. Daufany says I do well enough in school to be a teacher, if I want to be," she said. Then Will would chase her down the road, laughing, skip in circles around her. Sometimes he insisted on carrying her book bag as they walked to the schoolhouse together against the wind, and when they had conversations, Lena loved the way he thought a long while before he spoke. She liked to look at his steel gray eyes and his face that was full of flattering angles and wait for the words he might say. Sometimes Will said nothing at all. She knew Will fished with his father Angus because that was what he knew how to do, but Will said he liked Lena's idea of leaving Slate Harbor. "Maybe I might like to start a store someday, move to Halifax," Will hinted. Now Lena could still hear Will promising her those things as she pulled on the rope and Will's yellow dory floated towards her like a wide open shell. She took the bow in her hands and took comfort in the smell of the sea that seeped in through the heaps of rockweed at her feet. Lena always loved the double-ended shape of the dory out on the water, which Will used to row out to his Cape Island boat. And even when Will did talk about starting a store or maybe even leaving Slate Harbor, she knew how proud the men of Slate Harbor were of their work on the sea. All her life she'd heard her father get up before daybreak to fish in any kind of weather, long line for ground fish, trawl, trap lobsters, depending on the season, all from his Cape Island boat, whose hull was painted in strong lime green with black trim, and sat with the grace of a bird on the water. Built with a high bow and low stern, the Cape Islander had a wide beam that gave a good open workspace. "These vessels, they're home on the water for us," her father would say. And when Lena was a small girl, she used to press her face to the window and wait for his boat to return to the jagged inlet of Slate Harbor. She'd watch her father dock along the gray, salt-weathered wharf, unload his fish into tubs on the platform. Sometimes she'd run down to meet him, and Lauren Tannard might smile at her while he stood over the trestle table, knife in hand, cleaning the fish. "Watch out now, Lena, I'm cutting the head off the nice haddock, you," he'd tease her, and he'd cut the fish and run the sharp blade of the knife down its soft belly so swiftly it were as if he were in rhythm to a tune no one could hear. Seagulls would flap and caw over their heads while he tossed the bloody curry over the side of the wharf, and the birds would dive for the feast, spin their shadows over the rooftops of the fish stores like black specks in a kaleidoscope. Lena used to think that if she stayed beside her father long enough, he wouldn't drink. Even when he'd take the sherry bottle into his hands and put his wet, red mouth around the lip of the bottle, his gullet moving in and out as he drank, with uncontrollable thirst, letting some of it seep down his chin and neck in a small stream. Lena winced, with a sickening feeling that she shouldn't be watching, like that morning when she found her parents standing naked against each other in the bathroom, calloused hand clasped over her mother's breasts and her father in between her legs that were spread out, like slow-moving wings, both of them moaning, their eyes having that same watery look that her father had now, drinking the sherry. Lena turned her head. That's when he'd say, "Go home now, Lena. Your mother needs you for help for dinner." And they both knew Lena's mother watched them from the kitchen window of their house farther back on the rocks. And she would run back from the wharf when her father had told her to go home, up over the rocks and past the small emerald patches of grass, past the long thin spruce boles that swayed back and forth with the clothesline in the wind. She'd run to her mother, who was waiting for her, and who might ask, "Bring in the clothes from the line, please, Lena." And Lena'd obey, no matter how hard the breeze off the ocean might blow. And she'd unclip the clothes and fold them in the basket, and the sweetness in the smell of the cotton would spring out at her as she put the clothes away in the drawers. And on a late summer afternoon when the wind died down, Lena could look out over the cove, and the stillness would bring the Cape Island boats sharply into focus as they lay anchored on the silver water, and everything in the village seemed to rest. Rest. Even now at midday, as Lena pulled the dory towards her, the village seemed to rest with the men gone out. She thought about the time when there were only women and children in the houses as she looked over her shoulder towards her own house, with the pane windows and green door that hid the truth of supper time, that hardest time of day. She could remember how her mother gave her potatoes to wash and peel for the cod chowder, and how she'd plunge her hands into a porcelain bowl of water and take one potato at a time and scrub the brown skin down to its flesh. That way Lena could forget the dread she was feeling as the hours moved closer towards supper time. She'd look out the window hoping her father might be walking up the path, but usually he wasn't. Usually the path only stared back at her with its emptiness. "Your father's no more than a ghost out at sea," her mother often said, as if the clouds had come in and the blue in her mother's eyes disappeared. They'd eat without him then, and after the dishes were done, they'd move in a pattern around the door, waiting for her father. But it got so that he'd only come home late, way after Lena and her mother tried to sleep. Their eyes wide open in the dark, they'd wait in their different beds for the sound of his dragged feet and the door pushed open. And now, years later, it was her own husband Will who was not coming home for dinner. And it was Lena who waited for him, late in the night, in her bed with her son Ivan in the next room. Earlier in the day, they had watched his Cape Islander come in, seen Will clean fish down on the wharf. But now it was her son Ivan who pressed his face to the window, who by 6 years old wanted to go down, help his father cut the fish. "Can I go now?" he'd asked Lena. "Can I go now?" And Lena would watch her son Ivan run down the loose boards of the wharf that clattered under the wild turmoil of gulls, and Will would look up from the trestle table just like her father had, his lips parted under his smile. And Ivan would run home later, and supper time would come, and they'd wait. But Will wouldn't come home. But last night, Lena had stayed up, waiting for Will. And when he shoved his body through the kitchen door, she begged him to stop fishing like he'd promised those years ago, so they could start a store. "Remember our dreams?" she cried, and she heard the hysteria in her voice. "Fishing is all I know, Lena," Will said. "Angus taught me everything I know about the sea, and there's no way I can throw that away." And his red lips hung like loose rubber from his face. She crumbled to the floor when he came at her like a dark shadow under the bare bulb light. His fists hit her body, and she was afraid because she didn't know how to hide from Will. She didn't know where their life had gone. Holding the bow of the dory in her hands now, Lena breathed in deeply and took stock of the boat. Now its bow rested on the rockweed while gulls swarmed over her head with their cries. She spotted the oars that lay in the bottom toward the stern, and she released the catch from the ring and pushed the boat out from the rocks as she jumped in the water, steadying herself on her feet, then sitting down on the thwart. She wanted to go out far into the sea. She wanted to row and row until she could only feel the muscles in her arm and the water hit the blades. Pulling the oars up, she set them in their toll pins, and she began to row out towards the mouth of the cove. And in her movements, there was still will in her eyes, always will, the man she had loved, even as she pushed off from the shore and past the wharf that stretched itself out from the fish store. The fish store all lit up silver in the bright sun. And Lena couldn't help but remember the inside of that old structure where she and Will used to go in the night, when she'd let Will stand behind her and press up against her, and his hands would find her skin beneath the cotton of her button blouse, and she was just 16 and Will 2 years older. And then that one night when Will said, "You're so beautiful, Lena. Did anyone tell you that?" And he gently turned her, lifted her skirt, and they fell back on the nets. No control then, just Will lifting himself up over her, and their breaths all fury while Will pushed inside her. And Lena can still remember that feeling of coming alive then, away from her mother and father, and how she mixed up the aliveness with her dreams, and then how she mixed up her dreams with Will. All of this flashing through her mind as Lena rowed beneath the noonday sun, surprised by how naturally the rowing came to her, even with her hands tied around the splintered spruce oars, and how riding along the water, she could see herself coiled beside Will that first summer in the fish store. And while the ocean roared in the distance past the point, the same point that Lena was rowing towards now, Lena could still see the rafters of the fish store as Will slept on top of her, and the sky's violet light seeping in through the cracks that stretched over her like rings of water, her back pressed sharply into the net twine beneath Will's weight, and how she would dream they were someplace else besides where they were now. She was a schoolteacher with neat black hair and a finely sewn dress in Halifax. She could imagine herself with 28 students in her class, and by the first week she knew all of their names by heart. Will had brought her here, and he had a store on Montague Street.
Thank you, Kip. That's really lovely, and you read so beautifully. We'll all look forward to the rest of the story when you've got the book finished and we can all go to the store and buy it. I'm Lorna Rees, and you're listening to Lopez Writers Read, and we're talking today with Kip Robinson Greenthal. Kip, you're working on another book as well about leaving your old family home. Now, I believe it's fiction, but I think it's based on your life. Is it memoir? Or is it fiction? And if it's from your life, why did you choose to do it as fiction?
Well, you know, I believe that stories are gifts. And in the same way the story came to me in Nova Scotia and the characters are a collage of a lot of different people I've known, I think the same thing is going to happen with East Lee. There's a lot of my own personal life that will inform the story. I think it would be hard to write it as a memoir. I find when I believe that I'm writing something that really happened, it's too difficult to write about. And that's true with characters. Any character who's at all like me, I just have such a hard time.
Understandable.
But if a character's fictional, then I can kind of take off, you know. I feel the freedom of fiction, and I don't feel I'm hampered down by hurting anyone's feelings or even wounding ghosts, mm-hmm. or those who've gone to the other world. And I feel respectful of that, because I think they still are a part of this world. And so in however I compose this story about what it is to leave a family home, I would like to look at it at this point in time with the eye of fiction.
I'm wondering, when you started writing, did you start writing really young?
Yes. I started writing when I was 6 years old.
Really?
Yes. I had no brothers or sisters, and writing was my best friend, was my sibling. So I would wake up in the morning lonely, and my parents were often, for a variety of reasons, they weren't around. So I spent a lot of time by myself, and writing just seemed to be my way to find companionship. I think that's part of why I never tried to make a living at writing when I was starting off making a living, mm-hmm. Because it was such a personal relationship that I had with writing. I don't think I wanted to put it under a magnifying glass or scrutinize it. It was still too personal for me at that point. So what I did was I just found jobs that had to do with writing or around the book, but not the writing itself. Although I always wrote and always knew deep down I wanted to be a writer. But I think because it was my best friend as a child, it was hard for me to objectify it and really put it under scrutiny.
So you chose to major in English literature as opposed to creative writing. Was that any kind of a difficulty choosing that, or pretty much a natural, because I'm guessing you read all the time too. People who write always seem to read all the time also.
Yeah, but I do have a surprise for you. I got my BA in literature and creative writing.
Oh,
so nice. Obviously...
I did say that, yeah. Sorry.
Well, I guess it's just always that hidden part of ourselves. You know, it was literature, mm-hmm. and also creative writing. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's just been myself. You know, you think of the light self and then, you know, the hidden self. And the writer has always been there in me. And it's just, you know, for whatever reason, I mean, I think there are many people, you know, their path on the road of art is not an easy one. And I've chose to have art be private for a long time. And I don't really know why that is, but I did. And so it's very interesting to be more out there in the world with it. And I feel fortunate to have the time. I feel very lucky to have the time to devote to the practice of writing now, and to learn as much as I've learned, and to live in the wonderful community of Lopez. It's so rich with so many talented writers.
That's for sure. And we're lucky to have them willing to come here to this little studio of ours and talk to us about their process and their work. I wonder if you would read us a little piece from, or some piece from, the other book that you're writing, The East Lee, because I know that's also in progress, but I think you've set it aside to finish, mm-hmm. Shoal Water. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right.
So, but that must also be something that a project that you love, because it is something that you've been working on or thinking about for quite, mm-hmm. some time as well.
Yeah, I have been. And I realize when I think of short stories, and I told you that Shoalwater sort of started with a series of short stories, the exact same thing is happening with East Lee. And what I have is a collection of pieces that are now in the first person. Which is a little different from Shoalwater. Shoalwater started from the point of view of individual characters. But this one is definitely in the first person. And when I get ideas for it, I will jot them down. I have a little journal where I jot down ideas. And so far the pieces have been pretty short, which is interesting. Shoalwater, as I told you, when I was trying to find a piece that I could read for 12 minutes, all of
yes.
the chapters seemed to be somewhat long. It would be nice to be able to shorten them a bit. But Eastleigh is starting out with much shorter pieces. So I will read from Stealing. It's a short piece that I wrote. And again, I think of it as fiction. And I see that I wrote it in first person, but I changed it to third person with the she. So
a little detachment.
Yeah, a little detachment. So I will read this now.
Thank you.
She steals from her parents' house 12 porcelain plates with cobalt trim, a dozen wine glasses wrapped in her polar fleece jacket, and 2 gold lamps with painted roses on their bases. Her hands sweat holding these things as she rushes from the house, worrying that the front door will slam shut before she comes back for the second load. The wind blows over the lake and into her lungs with a watery sweetness that doesn't mix with what she is doing. Last week, she took 3 waste paper baskets, a small brown wood mirror, a box of silver forks, spoons and knives, and paintings of flowers and crickets. Night is the best time to steal, when the neighbors can't see her put these things in her car. She puts them carefully on the soft seat and places towels around the china and glasses and picture frames that might break. Also, she takes things a little at a time, so that way it feels manageable. She tries to mix up the soft things with the hard things, trays, comforters, porcelain china, pillows, crystal. Her routine is regular. She goes to the house and does some work, pack up boxes of books, discard old calendars and files, go through her parents' clothes and bags them for the community services. Then later, she looks through the dark rooms and her breath rises up into her head until her eyes hurt because she knows these objects too well. They've been here over 50 years. Tonight, she will steal the silver candlesticks from the dining room table. These are the candlesticks that watch to learn to strike a match. She remembers standing at the dining room table when she was 10 years old. Her mother and father would not let her sit down to eat dinner until she had struck the match to light the candles. "Light the candles," they coaxed her. "What are you afraid of?" The walls of the room ferried around her. She did not understand why it was so important that she strike the match. "Light the candles," they said, and the world became the candle and the match and the voices of her parents. She watched the candle rise up from the silver candlestick, tall and soft and white, with a small wick coming through its center. Its beauty made her cry. She stood in the dark vacuum that was the dining room and her mother and father. Paralysis seized her fingers, and the matchbook slipped, and she could not strike. If she did, there would be the explosion of light, the door crashing open in the middle of the night that ripped up her sleep and her dreams. The explosion was her mother and father, her father yelling from the center of her bedroom, her mother following him with blood on the corner of her mouth. It was the bad blazing light. They could destroy each other in front of her if she let them, but she always begged them to stop. She was in a tryst with them when they came into her room in the dead of night. She didn't think about this when she tried to light the match. She only stood terrified, staring at the tall candle. Somewhere deep inside herself, she knew how quickly beauty can be destroyed. She knew the near death of love. Now, years later, she reaches for the silver candlesticks, as if for the first time she notices the decorative arbor that climbs up their stem from the base. She remembers that she did finally strike the match against the surface of the book with her parents watching. She remembers the blaze exploding and lighting the candle, and the flame reaching up like liquid gold from the wick. She remembers the smell of phosphorus in her fingers, and that the wax of the candle was as gentle as skin with a milky hue. The sound of her parents clapping, still snaps in the room. Lifting the silver candlesticks from the dining room table, they shed a sour scent of raw metal in her hands. She always loved these candlesticks, she thinks. Shoving them into her book bag, she turns off the lights and rushes through the rooms of her parents' house to the door. The wind still tries to slam it shut as she goes out. The lake still spills its watery sweetness inside her lungs. Making as little sound as possible, she takes her careful steps down the path to her car.
Thank you. That's a stunning story. I confess I've heard that story before, and I love it. Did you write 7 or more drafts of that?
You know, this is a case where it's almost, I don't know why this happens, but no.
It just came right out. All of you listeners out there who think you can write something in 2 drafts, don't pay attention to that.
Who knows? I mean, again, I heard Gary Snyder this morning, and he said a poem comes to you. Mm-hmm. Prose you have to labor on. A long piece you have to labor on. And I guess this piece felt like a poem almost that came to me. It just came very quickly, and I didn't have to belabor it. Whereas, you know, a novel or a long story, you really do have to labor over. So I don't know, it'd be nice to find that right blend, wouldn't it?
It would. I've talked to writers who feel that some of the writing just comes through them. Mm-hmm. It's not really a deliberative process. They get into a zone and then they get out of the way. And I think we all have that in us if we really are that committed to our writing, show up often enough at the desk or the computer or the page. Our muse or whatever it is that's in charge will say, oh, she's serious. Okay, let's get going.
Yeah, I think that's so true.
But your process, I know that you write every day, and for 2 to 4 hours, I think.
I try to.
Yes, and in my experience talking to writers, I've found that it's the writers who do commit the time and set it aside and take it seriously. Those are the writers who improve and who finish pieces of beauty. So I want to congratulate you on your process and the discipline.
Thank you.
It takes.
It's funny because I also think, I don't know if all writers are like this, but I can be very hard on myself about not being more disciplined. So it's nice to hear that because it is a challenge. Life gets in the way. And writing is a solitary pursuit, so it's a bit lonely. And, you know, especially when you're I admit that I deal with difficult subject matters, so it's very important to find that luminous thread that I talked about earlier with the magical realism, which is probably what will end up happening with Eastleigh. I don't quite know what form, I don't know quite what shape or form that will take, but I'm guessing the same thing will happen with it.
Well, that'll be another adventure. We've been talking with Kip Robinson-Greenthal today. Kip is working to finish her novel, Shoal Water, and then she will return to her second novel, Eastleigh, a story about leaving her old family home. You can read one of Kip's stories on Shark Reef, which is the literary magazine of the Lopez Writers Guild. That story, I believe, is called Tattoo Emporium, Kip. Do you feel like saying just a couple sentences about that story?
Yeah, that story is sort of I don't know quite where that's going to fit in. I don't know. It's a combination of personal and imaginative truth. It may be a part of Eastleigh, but it also just might stand on its own. You know, it addresses some of the major themes that I address, the family violence. And you know, working at New Beginnings, doing volunteer work, and I've wished I could get involved with it more on Lopez, but I haven't been able to give it the time. I want to finish this book, and then I will. But again, with the belief and hope and change that even when cruel acts occur that can be hurtful. There can be, going down into the ashes and really believing that things can heal and transform. And, that's the work that I'm doing in my writing. I realize that.
Good. Writing can be very therapeutic on a deep level, and not conscious always.
Yeah.
So that story is called Tattoo Emporium. To read it, go to sharkreef.org, and there's plenty of other fine writing by Lopez writers there as well. You've been listening to Lopez Writers Read on KLOI FM 102.9. This program is being pre-recorded. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I like to say, write on.